You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll hear from Israel, where we'll learn that even a nation founded as a haven for a minority is not always a safe place for minorities. We'll meet a photographer who has peeked behind all seven remaining fragments of the Iron Curtain. Our editor will preview his interview with His Honor himself, Mayor of New York City, Mike Bloomberg. And we'll continue Midori House's campaign to introduce itself to all of Midori House's neighbors. All that, plus unhappy Germans and some great music, coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before we unfurl that veritable cornucopia, do you unfurl cornucopias? I'm not sure. I'll give that some thought. The news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Spain's wealthiest autonomous region, Catalonia, is seeking a bailout from the central government because it's running out of options for refinancing debt this year. The announcement came from Catalan President Artur Mas. The debt burden of Spain's 17 highly devolved regions and rising bad loans at the country's banks are both at the heart of the Eurozone debt crisis because investors are concerned they could strain finances so much that Spain itself will need an international bailout. Catalonia, which represents one-fifth of the Spanish economy, has more than €13 billion in debt to refinance this year, as well as its deficit. A new UN watchdog report is warning that Iran has raised its potential capacity to make sensitive nuclear material by installing hundreds more uranium enrichment machines at an underground site. The warning comes a day after world powers failed to convince Tehran to halt such activity. The International Atomic Energy Agency has also said that satellite images show extensive activities at the Parchin military complex, which inspectors want to check in the light of suspicions that research relevant to nuclear weapons was carried out there. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate for president, Mohamed Morsi, is likely to face former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik in a runoff vote, according to early election results. More than 11,000 out of 13,000 polling stations have declared results in the first election since President Hosni Mubarak was overthrown last year. Scotland's Yes campaign for independence wants 1 million Scots to sign a declaration of support by the time of the referendum in the autumn of 2014. The Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond said independence would happen if that milestone was achieved. He also made clear his belief that the people of Scotland should make the decisions that affect the country.
If the Parliament can run education, then why can't it run the economy? If it can be trusted to run the health service, then why can't it represent Scotland internationally? If it can be trusted to protect our old people, then why can't we protect the country? And do so without the obscenity of nuclear weapons.
Senior Vatican sources say a butler who serves in the apartments of Pope Benedict has been arrested in connection with an investigation into leaks of confidential documents. The source confirmed reports by Italian media about the identity of the person. Austerity measures in the Netherlands that have followed the collapse of the government last month are dealing a death blow to arts in the country, according to those in the industry. The prestigious Rijksacademy was earlier this week denied government funding of €2.5 million. Its director, Els van Oordijk, warned that this would mean a loss of an entire generation of artists in the Netherlands. Art student Thomas Raat criticised the negative approach to the arts in the Netherlands.
The whole climate in the Netherlands has been drastically changed after the Geert Wilders party basically supported the government we have. The government now falls, but there's a very negative approach on everything cultural at the moment, which is very sad and not very stimulating.
The world's biggest and most advanced radio telescope, capable of detecting signs of extraterrestrial life in the far reaches of the universe, will be split between the two leading bidders for the project, South Africa and Australia with New Zealand. The decision was made today at a meeting of the nations controlling the project at Schiphol Airport in the Netherlands. South Africa's Minister of Science and Technology, Naledi Pandor, gave her reaction.
I'm ecstatic. I'm happy for our scientists. I'm happy for our country. I'm happy for Africa. We've done it. Who would have thought? So I'm thrilled. Of course you want, you know, everything, but getting 3/4 is pretty good in my view.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back to Midori House. The organised persecution of an ethnic minority is a depressing spectacle wherever it occurs, but something seems especially grotesque about marginalised people being attacked and their property destroyed in what is fundamentally an immigrant society. This, however, is exactly what has been occurring this week in the Hatikva neighbourhood of Tel Aviv, where thousands of protesters have been demonstrating against the presence of 60,000 asylum seekers, mostly from Africa, who've arrived in Israel in recent years. Joining me now is Ben Hartman, a reporter with the Jerusalem Post. Good evening, Ben.
Good evening.
How bad have these demonstrations or riots got?
Mm-hmm. Well, they've had these demonstrations over the last couple of years, occasionally, but none have had any sort of violence like what happened on Wednesday night, when you saw a few different stores vandalized and broken into and looted. And people randomly, you know, Africans randomly attacked on the street. So it's something that, while the anger and a lot of the messages behind these protests have been here for the last couple of years, they definitely, they certainly escalated a notch just in the last 2 weeks. And the violence that was at the Wednesday night protests is something that hasn't been at these other protests, even though they have been heated and they have had a tone of anger and resentment towards the press, towards the government, towards and certainly towards the foreigners.
Was there a particular spark this week that was the reason that it got more violent than previous demonstrations have been?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are a combination of things. The main thing I think that would be the main background to it all is just the rising numbers of the migrants to begin with. Which, you know, have averaged about, you know, over 2,000 per month. But in particular, in the last few weeks, what you've seen is a string of reports in the media about rapes allegedly committed, sexual assaults allegedly committed in South Tel Aviv by Eritrean or other East African migrants. There was a series of these reports. There were three. And you know, no one obviously has been convicted or anything like that yet, but it plays to this sort of this statement that's often made about the foreigners, about the African migrants, that they, you know, they pose a threat of rape, of robbery. They're, you know, there's a lot of fears and kind of stereotypes and whatnot about them and women, and that they'll, you know, attack our daughters, quote unquote, in these neighborhoods. And so when this issue of sexual violence gets out there, it definitely, you know, sparked a great deal of anger, and it brought the issue to the front page of the Israeli media in a way that it hadn't been in a while. It's kind of over the past 2 years, they started arriving in earnest about 5 or 6 years ago, and over the past 2 years, the issue has kind of ebbed and flowed in the media. It's had periods of times when it was on the front page, times when it kind of fell off, and recently, the last 2-3 weeks, it's really come back to the front page in a way that it hasn't ever before. Like it's a much bigger story now than it ever has been, and it's because of these stories of sexual assault, and then coming along with those is a lot of right-wing politicians who are trying to capitalize on it.
This is what I wanted to ask about, and how big a factor you thought that was. I mean, Miri Regev of Likud, in particular, has described the immigrants as a cancer in our body. Now, certainly in Britain, I think in most European and American countries, that would be a career-ending statement for a politician to make.
Right.
How is she still in a job?
Well, Miri Regev, how is she still in a job? How did she get in the job to begin with? Miri Regev is, you know, she's a well-known Likud MK. She's not one of the more powerful parliamentarians in Israel. She's not a minister. But I think I think what's probably potentially more worrisome, I think, for people is you know, look at statements made by the Interior Minister, because the Interior Minister, Eli Yishai, from the Shas party, you know, that's a very powerful minister. And, you know, and he's made statements about, you know, if I had the tools at hand, I would deport all of them at once, or we should jail all of them. Very, very strong statements that he's made against the Africans as of late. And this is the Interior Minister, which is one of the more powerful ministers. In terms of people like Miri Regev or Michael Ben-Ari and Danny Danone, these are, you know, right-wing politicians who are prominent, mainly because, I think, because of the statements they make about issues, mainly because of how did they, you know, they get out there and they make these statements. Someone like Michael Ben-Ari, who is a far-right MK, was a far-right activist for many years, he was born in Hatikva, and he grew up there, and he's someone who's made this kind of a pet issue for him. He's one of these classic kind of rabble-rousers who goes to these protests, who organizes these right-wing protests of all different types of provocative ways. And so he's, I think, the most, I think he's the politician who has done the most to try to piggyback on this issue, as it were, and to kind of, you know, to kind of capitalize on this issue as much as possible for himself. And it's made him more and more prominent as of late.
I mean,
now, whether or not, to what extent do I think that this incitement from the politicians is to blame for it? I think it's just part of it. It's just one of the ingredients. I mean, the anger and the resentment was there, and then the reports of rape and whatnot really caused a media frenzy. And I think, you know, at most, I think you could say that these politicians, you know, they sparked, you know, they gave the spark to what was already a very fertile ground for an explosion.
I mean, the twin phenomenons of, you know, opportunist conservative blowhards and anti-immigration sentiment aren't unique to Israel, but there does seem to be something, I mean, as I mentioned in my introduction, in an immigrant society in particular, in a country that was conceived as a haven for minorities, is anybody, if not taking the side of the immigrants, at least pointing out the ironies?
Well, I mean, there's certainly people who point out that irony of it. But I think, you know, as opposed to other immigrant societies, and I mean, Israel is a Jewish state, or supposed to be the Jewish state. So it's never been a society that supports, immigration in general. You know, it supports Jewish immigration. And so, you know, it's in a sense, it's not, while it is an immigrant country, to an extent, you know, almost unlike any other country in the world, it's never been one to actively seek out non-Jewish immigration. So I don't think, you know, in that sense, you would see a great contradiction. You know, there's other comparisons and whatnot people have made that are a bit ironic. But I don't think it's necessarily contradictory to, you know, the Zionist ideology, which is the ingathering of exiles from around the world, the ingathering of Jewish exiles. Whether or not somebody should say, well, as, you know, the country of a persecuted people, should Israel be extending its hand to help and bring in other refugees, I think most people would agree with that in principle. But the problem then arises and becomes more complicated. You say, well, how many? Should it be 60,000 over the course of 5 years in a country of 6 million people? Should it be people who we don't know if they're refugees? A lot of people don't, I would say the majority of Israelis don't believe that all of these people are refugees, or even that the majority are. So, in a sense, there is a desire to, you know, to help people, you know, that's born from the you know, the Jewish experience in the diaspora. But that sympathy and whatnot only goes so far when people see the numbers continue to rise, and when it's non-Jewish immigration, it just the Jewish immigration here has always been loaded, and there's always been, you know, ethnic conflict and social and class-driven conflict between the different types of Jewish immigrants here. That's been pretty heated. So when you bring in non-Jewish immigrants, it can be a very divisive issue.
How do you imagine this story progressing now? Is there a concern that there will be more violence, or that violence might spread, or what do you think happens next?
I think the writing on the wall for something, you know, like last week has been there for a long time. So I don't think what happened last night or last week on Wednesday was by any means unexpected. And I think it would be realistic to expect more actions like this, more incidents like this. I mean, I've been, you know, expecting this for a long time, but, you know, eventually somebody will get killed, eventually something, you know, it'll just explode because it's just got all the right ingredients there. I think you're going to see, or you've already seen, the police beefing up their patrols in South Tel Aviv, even before, you know, the vandalism and the looting and the race riot, as it were. Even before that, you know, they started beefing up their presence because of, you know, the reports of the rape and the rising crime rate, which statistically haven't really been borne out. But nonetheless, they beefed up their presence, and they're going to do that following this as well. You'll see the police on high alert, which I think could stave off, you know, some repeat incidents of violence. But I think that this issue has certainly not gone away, and all the ingredients are still there. There's still, you know, right-wing politicians who want to capitalize on it. There's still more and more, you know, there's still migrants arriving every month, and they're still being brought to these same neighborhoods. They're still being brought to these same areas and these same, you know, poorer areas of different towns in Israel. So you're still going to have this class-based resentment by people in places like Atikva, which, you know, are working-class neighborhoods, you know, poor working-class neighborhoods of right-wing Israelis, who, you know, see it as, you know, the establishment, again, you know, basically spitting on them and bringing these people, you know, to Tel Aviv. And, you know, again, it's, you know, this burden that's thrown on us again. And so these kind of resentment and class resentment and racial issues, you know, they're going to remain there. And they're not going away. I mean, they remain. I think there's definitely, there's a possibility that a lot of people, I think, were shocked by what happened. You know, a lot of people in Hatikva and Shapira neighborhood and these other working class neighborhoods where the Africans now live, are very angry about their presence there and want the government to do something, but they don't condone the use of violence or angry mobs. So a lot of these people are shocked as a result of it. But I would suspect that other people, you know, could be potentially emboldened by it. You know, when somebody else takes that first step, it's easier for others to follow. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we would see other worse incidents in the coming weeks, and it might not take much for it to happen. There could be a report of another, you know, crime by Eritreans at night, or just, you know, whatever. You know, the ground is very fertile for such a thing to happen. So I wouldn't be surprised to see something else in the next, you know, in the near future.
Ben Hartman at the Jerusalem Post, thank you very much for joining me on Midori House this evening. This is Monocle 24. We'll be back after this with a song.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers, putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
Time now for a musical interlude. This is The Bamboos with Wilhelm Scream.
Might as well love you.
That was The Bamboos with Wilhelm Scream. You're listening to Midori House. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. 21st century communism seems, on the face of it, a contradiction in terms. Indeed, the unravelling of the Soviet bloc between 1989 and the mid-1990s had the effect of making the 20th century seem like it had ended a decade or so early. There remain, however, a few indefatigable holdouts, still saluting the Scarlet Standard with all the history-defying obduracy of, for example, Lieutenant Hiro Onoda, the Japanese officer who famously waged World War II until 1974. The proverbial banner bright, the symbol plain, still flies over China, North Korea, Cuba, Nepal, Vietnam, Laos and Moldova. Photographer Thomas Van Hoetrieve has visited all seven remaining communist countries and chronicled his travels in a beautiful book called Behind the Curtains. Thomas joins us now on the line from Paris. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
How difficult was it to actually work inside these countries? Communist regimes have sort of were always famous for being not terribly welcoming towards photographers, especially.
Yeah, and that still holds true today. The media remains state controlled. You know, there's only party run newspapers in most of these places. But since the Cold War is over, there's a bit less suspicion between East and West, and they've opened up a space for tourism. And of course, tourists are allowed to carry cameras. So by going to some countries many, many times, for example, Cuba, I went seven times as a tourist, I was eventually able to collect the photos I needed for this book.
You weren't always able to go as a tourist, though. Getting into North Korea, you not only had to forge a new political identity and acquire a new passport, you even had to go to the extreme of growing a moustache.
Yes, and setting up a false website, because the thing is, North Korea, there are a few journalists who have managed to go in as tourists, and all of the major monuments and museums have already been photographed. So I was trying to get something else, something that we hadn't seen yet. And I found two different delegations that go to North Korea. One was a friendship and solidarity delegation, and the other one was a business delegation. And of course, to get onto that one, I had to pose as a businessman, you know, equipped with brochures, business cards, and a false website. But once I got in, I was able to see, you know, new things that hadn't been photographed before, the inside of hospitals, military academy, and inside of factory floors and things like that.
I mean, you're absolutely right in the case of North Korea in particular, where on the rare occasions you do read a story from inside North Korea or see pictures from inside North Korea, it is, as you said, pretty much the same thing every time because access is always tightly controlled. Was there one particular thing in North Korea or one particular image, I guess, in North Korea that surprised you that wasn't what you'd been expecting to see?
I've got one moment where I'm turning over to the page in the book here where they took us to a shooting range. This was part of the friendship and solidarity thing. And there was a shooting range in these sort of old sports facilities that I think they'd shown off to visiting athletes from Soviet countries before the end of the Cold War. And so, you know, I don't know which other country would take friends of that country to go out shooting. And they had live chickens in the shooting range and things like that. And I managed to just take a few shots in there, but I have one shot where a woman is holding a silver pistol in her hand, and she's about to recharge it, and she turns over looking at me as I'm lifting the camera, and you can see a bit of the paranoia and the distrust in her eyes. But there's a bit more in the picture. Often you see people posing in North Korea or always in parades and mass sort of propaganda demonstrations. But here you see it a little bit more. She has some very feminine jewelry on her arm, and she's caught at an off moment. So you can see the individual, you can see the paranoia, and you can see a scene that I haven't seen photographed before in North Korea.
I'm looking at that image now on page 71. That is a heck of a sidelong glance you're getting there. It could mean one of several things.
still, she wouldn't need the pistol, right?
not just in North Korea, but in the countries you visited generally, when you spoke to people as opposed to just taking their pictures, did you find any hint of a genuine revolutionary zeal still attached to the idea for communism, or, you know, still this kind of idea of a global dictatorship of the proletariat, or are these people just waiting for history to wake up?
There is a bit of a generational split on that, and I would say in both Cuba and in Moldova, the older generation had at the very least nostalgia. These are people who had lived through whatever was before communism, many of them, and in the case of Cuba, it was the Batista dictatorship. In the case of Moldovans, it was the Nazi army occupying their country. So they could compare it to something perhaps even worse, and they'd taken part of the revolution, and once you've spilt your own blood or sacrificed for an idea, I guess it's a little bit harder to give it up. The young people who were born into this situation, they just can't wait for it to change.
Yeah, that's what I found much the same myself in traveling in, not dissimilar, and in fact, one or two of these places, that it's exactly that. There's the generation, the older generation missed the certainties, and the younger generation sort of would like the hope and the ambition that they're being denied. From a photography point of view, though, leaving aside the politics, what's your view of the visual aesthetics of communism? Always seemed to me to tend towards this sort of campy kitsch. Did you find that?
There's a lot of that, and that might be partially a Slavic thing. So you have it in Eastern Europe, but in some of the other countries, I don't know, how can I put this? Each country that's left today is very, very different because this center of power, the Soviet center of power, is no longer there. So there's much more distinction between the different cultures and geography that are left, as they're all heading off in their own direction trying to survive. But there are echoes that you see in each country. You do see the cult of personality. You see the red banner. I remember going inside an apartment building in Laos, and it looked exactly like the apartment block that I'd seen in Cuba. And the inhabitants told me it had been built by Soviet engineers in the 1980s. So some of the decor is the same. One thing that's very different from Western capitalist countries is you just don't see much advertising. Instead, you know, it's only one person in the center or one group in the center that decides which posters and which billboards go up. So that's quite strange.
Thomas, thank you very much for your time this evening. That was Thomas Van Hootrever, photographer, whose book Behind the Curtains, it's a tour of 21st century communism, such as his beautiful and extraordinary book, will be released in the UK on the 14th of June. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Londonból ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24 です.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
London ist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Londres, tämä on Monocle 24.
Londres, burası Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll talk to Monocle's Edits editor about what's in his section of Monocle's print edition. We'll talk to Monocle's editor about his meeting with New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, and we'll go out to buy some fruit. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news.
Spain's wealthiest autonomous region, Catalonia, is seeking a bailout from the central government because it's running out of options for refinancing debt this year. The announcement came from Catalan President Artur Mas. A new UN watchdog report is warning that Iran has raised its potential capacity to make sensitive nuclear material by installing hundreds more uranium enrichment machines at an underground site. The warning comes a day after world powers failed to convince Tehran to halt such activity. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate for president, Mohamed Morsi, is likely to face former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik in a runoff vote, according to early election results. More than 11,000 out of 13,000 polling stations have declared results in the first election since President Hosni Mubarak was overthrown last year. Senior Vatican sources say a butler who serves in the apartments of Pope Benedict has been arrested in connection with an investigation into leaks of confidential documents. Scotland's Yes campaign for independence wants 1 million Scots to sign a declaration of support by the time of the referendum in the autumn of 2014. The Scottish First Minister, Alex Salmond, said independence would happen if that milestone were achieved. And austerity measures in the Netherlands that have followed the collapse of the government last month are dealing a death blow to arts in the country, according to those in the industry. The prestigious Rijksacademy was earlier this week denied government funding of 2.5 million euros. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. Now, every day this week on Midori House, we've been chatting with the writers and editors behind the stories featured in the latest edition of Monocle's print edition, which is now on newsstands around the world. And today, it's the turn of Santiago Tarditi, who oversees the edits section of Monocle. Santiago, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Andrew?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, good.
What does your edit section have this month?
Well, it has the usual segments in it. Of course, we have a selection of the best products, design products from around the world.
What's a particular highlight of the best design products this month?
I like the Bruno bike. This is a mini velo, so it's a small bike, not your regular size bike. This is a Swiss design, but made in Japan. So it's very nice, especially now and during spring and summer.
When you say a small bike, is this one of those bikes that folds up?
It's similar in size, but it doesn't fold up.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's all in one piece. But, yeah, it's a very comfortable, portable size.
Is that harder or easier to navigate in a big city than a normal size bike?
Well, if you're someone as tall as I am and as clumsy as I am, it's quite difficult. But I guess other people can ride around the town with not many problems. Readers should also have a look at the newly opened Ryokan in Uwajima. We sent Kenji Hall to cover it. It's a beautiful, beautiful hotel that just opened in this town. Also injecting a bit of energy to the whole area. It's beautifully made, everything, all the food is locally sourced. It's all family run. It's a beautiful place.
Okay, it sounds very much like the sort of hotel we would recommend.
Yeah, of course. it's right up our street. But the main piece I wanted to talk to you about today is the one I wrote. This is for the food and recipe section. And I went to Monte Carlo to...
It's a tough life you lead, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult. I have to go to Monte Carlo and eat. That's part of my job. But I went there because there's this new restaurant that was actually recommended by a hotel manager in the same city. That is very nice. It's very different from the other restaurants you will find in a city. They're usually boring restaurants.
Well, yeah, because weirdly, given that it's basically in France, Monte Carlo doesn't really have any reputation for cuisine at all.
Exactly, not at all. Because I think they just rested on the laurels of the 90s and the culinary scene of the 90s with all this bling and weird preparations.
See,
my
one brief visit to Monte Carlo, I didn't get the impression it had progressed much past about 1975.
Oh, really?
that was a while ago, of course. They may have caught up a little bit since then.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because actually these guys are going further back. They're taking the restaurant scene back to the 1920s, 1930s. They've opened this restaurant. It's called Bouchon. It's opened by Ricardo Giraudi. His family has been importing meat for 50 years, and it was designed by local architect Emile Humbert. And what they did is they created the atmosphere of Paris or Nice in the 1920s, 1930s. So they created this very welcoming, cozy bistro/brasserie, serving simple food, laid-back atmosphere, and two of the recipes they shared with us are the steak tartare, Which one would think is easy to prepare, but it actually...
It's a pretty easy dish to get wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it has an intricate process that you have to follow in order to get right. And the crepe Suzette, a French classic.
Well, that's a good test one, because if you're in a French restaurant and they can't get the crepe Suzette right, then...
it's not a French restaurant.
Exactly. You can probably leave at that point. But they do get the crepe Suzette right?
Yeah. Very, very good. Very thin crepes, which is, I think, what you want to go for when you're preparing a dessert like this. And the tartare was also superb, yeah. And they have a great selection of wine. So, as I said, I think it's a welcome addition to the restaurant scene in Monaco.
And is the rest of the Monte Carlo restaurant scene really that grim?
I stayed there 2 or 3 days, and I think this was the only one that really captured my attention.
It is weird, though, isn't it? Because you'd think in a place that people go to looking to have a good time, some of whom have got lots of money, you would think there would be someone willing to take advantage of that.
I don't know. Maybe I think that a lot of the people that go there just go there to show off, and they're probably new money, and they're not really interested in food from an appreciation point of view. So they just want to go and buy the most expensive bottle and the most expensive dish and so on, and just show off with their fellow peers and their very sexy Ukrainian models.
So who is eating at this place?
At this place, actually the true locals. So of course, lots of people come from both Italy and from France, and you will find the customers there are people that stay hours. They get there in the morning, read their newspaper, have a coffee or two, stay for lunch, and they might even have time to get an aperitif just before hitting the town.
See, that does sound nice, and now I'm wishing they'd open somewhere like that in London, because I think this city has a real shortage of places like that. It sounds great. Santiago Tarditi, Monocle's Edits editor, thank you very much for talking us through your section of the magazine. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 の時間です。
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, for decades, comedians and taxi drivers, especially in Britain, have enjoyed amusing themselves and occasionally their audiences with jokes about the dour, gruff, humourless tendencies of the Germans. According to a new study, however, these jokes, however elderly and cobweb-covered, may be rooted in truth. A survey by Cologne-based market research consultancy Rheingold found that 46% of Germans are unable to enjoy anything, skewing up to 55% for younger Germans. Dear, oh dear. Joining us now is Monocle's correspondent in Berlin, Kimberly Bradley. Good evening, Kimberly.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm very well. How accurate do you think this survey is?
I think it's quite accurate if you just look at the general mood of the shopkeepers or anyone you really encounter in Germany. It's not a jovial country. No.
See, we do really try to get through the next 6 or 7 minutes or so without resorting to the more obvious stereotypes. But
okay.
but that is true. But at the moment, in particular, shouldn't the Germans at least be happier than anybody else in Europe?
They should be, because their economy is basically the strongest. I mean,
they still have an economy.
Yeah, exactly. Germans don't. I think they worry. I think part of not them not being able to enjoy certain things is just a sense of worry. I think also that there's this was mentioned in the study too. They're often jealous of people who can let loose, and so they're sitting kind of fat in the middle of Europe, but a little bit angry that the Greeks had sun and fun for so long, and they don't really think of anything beyond that.
So do you think there's something in that? That there's a kind of jealousy or envy of their sort of carefree, profligate Mediterranean cousins?
Absolutely. Although I'm wondering even how true it is, because there have been other studies that say that Greeks in terms of hours work more than the Germans do, the Greeks who work. That's another story. There's a word in German called Neidgesellschaft, which means culture of jealousy. And I could say, as an American expat, I felt it here quite often. And like, if something good happens to someone else, or if somebody's doing well, an American, for example, might think, "Oh, I can do that too. Let's get inspiration." And a German will think, "Ooh, how did he or she do that? I want that too." And they get a little bit strange. I mean, there's a reason that the word Schadenfreude doesn't have a translation.
Which is an absolutely excellent word, and I was going to mention that, in that I was wondering, is there, and I speak as an Australian who lives in Britain, and the British, well, specifically the English, were once unbeatably characterised by the New Yorker's editor David Remnick as being the only people who exhibit Schadenfreude towards themselves. But do you think there might be something of that about the Germans? Do they kind of enjoy being miserable and feeling put upon?
It's a good question. I don't think they enjoy it, actually. I think they try to have fun, but the trying is what keeps them from having fun and letting loose and relax. I'm sorry, this is starting to make me laugh. I think of some personal anecdotes where I've watched Germans try to get onto the dance floor, but they just can't do it.
As you say, you have the advantage of having spent a lot of time there. What does it look like when Germans try to enjoy themselves?
Occasionally you do get those who can, and that's kind of a wonderful thing to observe. When you see people who cannot, it's a bit painful. It's like a child on the playground who just is too afraid to join the other children. It's hard to see this. It makes me a little sad. So, I could give you an example. During the 2006 World Cup, which was hosted here, that was the one time I've seen the Germans totally at ease and happy. It felt as if they had been given permission to even fly the German flag and be a little bit proud of being German. I mean, they spent decades under this burden of history and not really allowed to be nationalistic in any way. And so it's like, okay, we're German, we're all right. And there was a lightness in the air, and people were happy until the 4th of July, when the Germans lost in the last 5 or 6 minutes to the Italians. And it was as if the black cloud returned, and everything was as it had been before.
you mentioned that burden of history, and I think at this point we're probably going to have to break the don't mention the war rule, which I did try to set myself at the outset of this item. But is it trying too hard to suggest that maybe there is a kind of a guilt or heaviness, or if you will, Weltschmerz, hanging over from the early 20th century?
I think it's true to a certain extent. I think the younger generation is slowly shaking it. I think the older generation was very much taught to not express too much emotion, to not discuss certain things, which even in family, I've spent quite a lot of time in German families, like more personal relationships. A lot of things from that era were not discussed until quite recently. Even the literature and movies came out only in the last 10 or 15 years. So yes, it was a hush, and it was a bit of an unspoken rule that you didn't talk about certain things, which of course makes people not especially forthcoming emotionally. Yeah.
I mean, Germans obviously are aware of this stereotype of them. What do they say about it? Do they resent it, or do they accept it, or how do they feel about it?
I think they're a little bit embarrassed by it, and I think that some people I know who are German try to get over it by living for a few years abroad, and then they become far more relaxed. I've noticed this as well with people who've left and come back. It's a bit of an embarrassment for some, or you may meet others and they deny it. Like, no, this is normal. This is how we are. It's like, okay, super.
Kimberly, with that, the night is still young, obviously, in Berlin. Go out and smile at some Germans.
I will. It may or may not work. They don't often smile back.
And we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be right back after this.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, We cover people-centered businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
The latest edition of The Entrepreneurs kicks off in Italy, where we'll be trying out the much-anticipated NTV high-speed rail network, being hailed as a transformative service for business travellers. We'll then be off to the West Bank, where some local entrepreneurs are bringing the traditional Arabic keffiyeh scarf back to life.
Buying one from Palestine helps the Palestinian economy more than buying one from China helps the economy. I'd rather have the real thing.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. Regular readers of Monocle magazine and regular listeners of Monocle 24 will be aware of our preoccupation with urban centres and how they can be better run. It's hard to imagine a sterner test of whatever ideas one may have on this front than spending a decade in charge of one of the world's most inspiring and maddening metropolises, New York City. The man who has done exactly that, Michael Bloomberg, spoke earlier to Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Andrew joins us now to give us a preview of that interview.
Yes, because we're slightly saving this interview for the quality of life issue, which we're working on at the moment. But Mayor Bloomberg is in London town today, and his people spoke to our people, and we agreed to meet.
and how did you find him? Is he one of those American politicians who appears with an enormous entourage of men with earpieces, or does he try to be a sort of more humble man of the people sort?
There was a man who looked like he knew how to kind of wrestle me to the ground if I asked the wrong question or if I got too close. And then there were two of his aides who do the job of the aides. They were kind of, you know, they were worried and concerned and making sure everything was like how he'd want it. And then he arrives and he's super cool and happy and amazingly friendly and funny and good on a quote or two.
Well, I would think at this point, I don't think that's a job you get without being able to talk.
No, and so in the coming issue, we have a piece about Amanda Burden, who's one of the people who runs the kind of city planning for New York, and a woman who is reasonably senior and has had, in the sense that she had several marriages in the past, and he was quite gossipy. Oh my God, you should read this book that tells her life in the 1960s. You know, she was part of the It couple. So he was, you know, he was warm, but it was when we got talking about the real how you run cities, and especially American cities, that he was actually, you know, he says the surprising thing. He isn't a guy who's trying to stay on script, and I guess that's like we have Boris Johnson here in London. I think mayors have realised that they don't have to kind of follow party politics or to kind of stick to one line. They're spokespeople for their city. They can be colourful and they can be challenging. So we talked about migration, and it was really interesting. He was saying that the great thing about New York is that people want to go there and that people want to move there. And he's not very keen on deporting illegal migrants. So he believes that people who have kind of got to America, and especially the ones who've got there legally, you should embrace them. You should make the most of them. He says, you know, if you look around the world, the people who are willing to give up life in their village, the people they know, the language that they speak, their traditions, their safety net, to get on a boat or on a plane and make it to America and somehow kind of find a job. He said, they're the people who in this world are the most eager, hardworking, wanting to change society, wanting for things to be better, and that you should embrace them. And he says, you know, that's the great thing about New York, that actually most of the people who arrive in the States, they want to go to New York. And, you know, he's not saying, oh my God, this is a nightmare, we don't have the housing, or we don't, you know. He's saying it's a good thing. And he's saying, you know, look at America and look at New York. New York is a city that has endlessly created jobs for people on the lower tier. He called them starter jobs. And he didn't kind of dismiss them as kind of cheap labour. He said, these are starter jobs. These are people where migrants will come in and they will work up and they will be the people who run businesses in 10 years' time.
And their kids will do, you know, their kids will go into tertiary education in 20 years' time and so on and so on.
Yeah, and he had quite a provocative word or two for Detroit, which we'll be using in the magazine. He was saying that he thought that actually, perhaps, and he was being a little bit provocative, he said, perhaps the rule should be that if you want to go and live in America, it's fine, we'll embrace you, but you have to live for the first 5 years in Detroit. and he said that the mayor of Detroit had told him off once for saying this before, and had said, we haven't got the jobs. And he said, you won't have the jobs until you embrace these people. You allow 24,000 people to move into Detroit, they will want services and they will want things to happen, and suddenly you will create the jobs.
Yeah, I think we can divine from that statement that if he is running for president, he's already written off Michigan.
Yes. I think. although apparently he said that he'd spoken once to the mayor of Detroit by phone, who had not been so happy with what he'd said. But apparently on a state level, they'd said, actually, we are trying to get people to move here. We do believe that that's a way of kind of triggering change in our cities.
What did he talk about as sort of like, things he's proudest of in his decade in charge?
Top of that list was the crime rate. He says that New York is one of the safest places to live in the world. And he said these days, his phrase was, you have to work quite hard to get murdered in New York. You have to do one or two things. You have to become a drug dealer, or you have to be married to somebody who's going to kill you with domestic violence. Those are the two ways that people die. He says, you look at everything else. You look at safety on building sites. You look at the number of people who've died in fires in houses. All these figures have fallen dramatically. And they've gone from a period just over 15 years ago when there was a murder rate of 2,500 in New York to a figure that's closer to 500 now.
And just quickly, I guess, did he give any sense of whether he thinks those ideas can be exported, or is everything he does specifically geared to the extremely peculiar city he's mayor of?
No, and I wasn't quite sure that he was correct in this, he felt that certainly there were some elements of New York that were very specific to New York. He was saying that he felt that London, and maybe if we'd had time, I would have liked to have quizzed him about the summer riots, but he was saying that he felt that London suffered in a way that when communities moved here from migrant communities, that they would live completely separately. Whereas in New York, the special thing about the city was that actually people mixed themselves up. I'm not quite sure that is exactly true, but he was pointing out the example of some of the biggest Irish Catholic communities in New York also happen to be the home to the biggest Muslim communities as well, and that there's no trouble. So he felt that that was something very special about New York. But I think that on a governance level, yes, he believes that the things that he's learned are exportable, that you could offer them to other cities, and you can certainly tweak the tail of the mayor of Detroit when he's not looking.
And very quickly, when can we read this?
This will be in the July-August issue, which is the ranking of the top 25 cities to live in the world, and that's out mid-June.
Andrew Tuck, Monocle's editor, thank you very much for joining us.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 laget, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 er jo også.
Dette
Monocle
24. Dette Monocle
24.
This is Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's Friday and it's sunny, which makes it even a nicer time to saunter around the block and meet one of Monocle's lovely neighbours. And today, Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited Blandford's fruit store, which is on Blandford Street and is owned by Eric Blandford.
I'm Turkish Cypriot. I was born in Cyprus and I came to this country very long time ago, which is well over 40 years. I've been in this shop where I'm working now as a fruit and vegetables shop. I've been here since 1976. This shop has been established, it's a very small shop. It's been here since 1923. Used to be owned by two English brothers, which they are not around anymore. Obviously they died, and afterwards, someone else took over in 1971 when they passed away. And then I took over in 1984. I worked as an employee for 8 years, from 76 till 84. And then when my predecessor, they decided to retire, I took over the business in 84. And I'm still here. We're specializing in only fresh produce, like fresh fruit and vegetables and salad. We try to get the best quality as we can, the best product available in season, actually, whatever is around, and we manage to keep it here in the shop for the customers. It comes from all over the world, actually. For instance, in the summer, we try to keep the local fruit from the local suppliers, like grown in England or in Europe. In the wintertime, lots of things comes from far away, like South Africa, South America, like from Brazil, we get beautiful mangoes and papayas, and we get nice grapes and cherries from Chile, which is fantastic, and also from Israel we get quite a lot of different exotic fruit, like avocados and pineapple, lychees. In the summer we sell lots of berries, like strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, cherries, apricots, peaches, nectarines, watermelon, lots of lovely fruit in summer, very juicy fruit, sweet. When it's hot, people intend to eat more fruit. Marylebone is a very nice area, which is very cosmopolitan, and you get lots of professional people around. It's like nearer to Harley Street and Marylebone High Street. We get lots of professional people comes in, and it's nice to see these people around.
That was Eric Blandford of Blandford's Fruit Store talking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all we have time for on Midori House. Our producer was Daniel Giacopelli. Our researcher was the very same Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Thank you all very much, gentlemen. In just 3 hours from now at 2200 hours here in London, I will be back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. We'll be talking about Egypt and much more besides. Up next is the news, followed by this week's episode of The Menu. Thanks for listening.